July 9, 1970, Lansing, Michigan. 16-year-old Lori Murnaghan, the daughter of the city's former mayor, is abducted from her workplace by a black male during a robbery gone wrong. 11 days later, Lori's decomposed body is discovered in a remote swampy pond, and her cause of death is determined to be strangulation. Even though Lori's employer picks out a promising suspect from a photo lineup who has an extensive criminal record, the authorities do not believe there is enough evidence to arrest this man. So Lori's murder officially remains unsolved. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering the unsolved abduction of a teenage girl which took place over 50 years ago, the 1970 murder of Lori Murnaghan. That voice you just heard narrating this intro was Michelle Bolesky, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Michelle. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been holding for nearly 4.5 years now, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, the murder of Lori Murnaghan is the case Michelle suggested I cover when she originally entered the contest, as she hails from Lansing, Michigan, the city where this crime took place. In fact, Lori's father had recently served a 4-year term as Lansing's mayor, so this case wound up being a pretty big deal when it happened. It seemed like Lori was a victim of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, as she was in the middle of working her shift at a local gift-slash-antique shop when someone attempted to rob the place and abducted Lori when things went wrong. For a week and a half, there was hope that the perpetrator had simply kidnapped Lori in a panic and would do the right thing and return her unharmed, but that was not to be, as her body would be found in a remote area outside the city. Even though Lori's boss had been present when her abduction took place and was able to identify a suspect from a photo lineup, the police believed that the evidence was not strong enough to charge him with murder. However, in recent years, allegations have emerged that the authorities may have had a vested interest in protecting this man because he was an informant, but we'll explore that angle later on. Also, after I finish covering Lori's case, I'm going to discuss another unsolved murder involving a teenage girl which took place in Lansing 9 years later. This time, the victim was 14-year-old Karen Oatley, who also happened to be hearing impaired, and no one has ever been able to uncover a promising suspect or figure out what the motive for this crime might have been. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let's now start off by exploring the murder of Lori Murnaghan. Our story begins in Michigan in 1970, and our central figure is 16-year-old Lori Murnaghan, who lives in the state's capital city of Lansing. Lori's parents are Max and Patty Murnaghan, and she is the third of 4 children, as she has an older sister named Marcy an older brother named Mark, and a younger brother named Patrick. The Murninghams are one of the community's most active and prominent families, as Max served one term as mayor of Lansing from 1965 until 1969, though he lost his bid for re-election. Lori has just completed her junior year at J.W. Sexton High School and currently has a part-time summer job at Gallagher's Gift and Antique Shop, located on Saginaw Street. After returning from a 4th of July vacation to New Hampshire with her family, Lori went to work her shift at the shop on July the 9th alongside her 55-year-old boss, Christine Gallagher. At around 2 p.m., a young black man walked into the shop and asked Lori for change for a $20 bill. When Lori told him that she was unable to make change, he suddenly pulled out a small-caliber pistol and grabbed her. When Gallagher tried to intervene, the man struck her on the head with his gun, which caused the weapon to accidentally discharge before she fell to the floor. The man then proceeded to abduct Lori from the shop, and by the time Gallagher recovered and regained her senses, she contacted the police. It would turn out that a robbery had taken place, as $64 was stolen from the cash register, and the bullet which had been discharged from the gun was fired into the ceiling. Needless to say, since Lori was the daughter of the city's former mayor, a massive search effort and publicity campaign was launched to find her, and it would involve several law enforcement agencies, including the FBI. The blow to Gallagher's head with the gun had caused a gash that required 11 stitches, but she was not seriously injured. Following her recovery, she provided a description of the assailant to the police, who put together a composite sketch that was circulated throughout the media. He was described as being a light-skinned black male with a goatee, who appeared to be around 20 to 25 years old, and he had worn a yellow shirt, dark trousers, and a straw hat. It was theorized that when the suspect's gun accidentally discharged and Gallagher fell to the floor, he might have mistakenly believed that he killed her, so he panicked and abducted Lori from the shop because she was a witness. Within hours of her disappearance, Max Murninghan went on television and made a public plea for Lori's abductor to return her alive, stating, quote, "Since Mrs. Gallagher is not seriously injured, do not harm an innocent girl and cause yourself greater trouble," end quote. Gallagher herself would also make her own televised plea to assure the abductor that she was okay, so if he returned Lori unharmed, the charges against him would not be that serious. On July the 10th, Max received a phone call from a man who claimed to have information about Lori's abduction and demanded that Max leave $200 by a drinking fountain at a park in the city of Flint, located over 55 miles away. When Max informed the Flint Police Department about this, the money was left at the location provided by the caller while they staked the area out. A man eventually showed up to retrieve the money, and after he was arrested and taken into custody, he was identified as 43-year-old Carl Nels. But Nels was ultimately ruled out as having any involvement in Lori's disappearance, as he had only been trying to cash in on the massive publicity surrounding the case. Nels was charged with extortion, and later received a prison sentence of 2.5 to 20 years. In the 11 days following Lori's abduction, the authorities investigated over 1,500 tips, but tragically, she would not be recovered alive. At around 4:45 p.m. on July the 20th, a pair of boys who were looking for empty pop bottles on a rural country road located 22 miles southeast of Lansing, when they came across the body of a young female about 15 feet from the road. The victim was heavily decomposed and lying face down in a swampy pond, and her body had been obscured by weeds and tall grass. It wasn't long before dental records positively identified her as Lori Murninghan. Following an autopsy, the county coroner expressed his belief that Lori was murdered and had her body dumped at the location on the same day she was abducted, but due to the level of decomposition, he could not determine if she was sexually assaulted. Lori's exact cause of death was initially withheld from the public, but 4 months later, it was revealed that she had died by asphyxiation after she was manually strangled. Lori's funeral was attended by hundreds of people, and her favorite song, Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water, was played in tribute. A Lori Murninghan Memorial Scholarship Fund would soon be established in order to help send other female students from J.W. Sexton High School to college. Anyway, after helping police create a composite sketch of Lori's abductor, Christine Gallagher looked through a number of mugshots, and she wound up coming across a photo of a suspect, which caused her to instantly break down in tears and identify him. Now, this man's name has never been released publicly by law enforcement, so I won't be using it on this episode, but he had an extensive criminal record after being arrested for numerous offenses in both Michigan and his former hometown of Toledo, Ohio. While the suspect's fingerprints could not be found in Gallagher's gift and antique shop, a print which matched him was found on an inhaler box in the pharmacy located next door. When investigators interviewed this man, his mother provided him with an alibi for the afternoon when Lori's abduction took place, though she reportedly appeared to be very agitated while the questioning took place. During one of the suspect's interrogations, he was injected with the truth serum, sodium pentothal, even though the United States Supreme Court had already ruled that confessions produced by truth serum were unconstitutionally coerced and inadmissible. Regardless, the results of the truth serum testing on this man were inconclusive. It seemed that the case against him fell apart when he was placed in a police lineup, but Christine Gallagher was unable to identify him. However, it's worth noting that Gallagher had poor eyesight and always wore eyeglasses with extra thick lenses. And even though Gallagher described the attacker as having a goatee, and this particular suspect was sporting a goatee in his mugshot when she identified him, he was clean-shaven by the time he appeared in the police lineup. In the end, investigators just did not believe the evidence against him was strong enough to file murder charges. 9 years later, the investigation into Lori's murder would be briefly linked to another infamous case. Some of you might be familiar with the story of James Dallas Egbert III, a child prodigy from Dayton, Ohio, who entered Michigan State University in East Lansing at age 16. On August 15, 1979, Egbert disappeared from his dorm room at the university, leaving behind a suicide note, and he would not be tracked down and recovered safely until 1 month later. On the day he originally went missing, Egbert had made a failed suicide attempt by consuming methaqualone in the university's steam tunnels, and while he wound up surviving, he eventually died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound in August of 1980. The story wound up ballooning into a moral panic because Egbert was a fan of fantasy role-playing games such as Dungeons & Dragons and had reportedly played live-action sessions of the game in the steam tunnels. This led to speculation that Egbert had taken his own life because these games had caused him to lose his grip on reality and have a psychotic episode. For this reason, Dungeons & Dragons and other fantasy RPGs were surrounded by controversy for years, but in actuality, Egbert suffered from depression and other mental health issues brought on by the pressure of being a child prodigy, which likely paved the way for his suicide. Well, in September of 1979, shortly after Egbert was found alive following his initial disappearance, Lori Murningham's case wound up being linked to the saga thanks to a woman named Cindy Hulleberger, who worked as a paint clerk at a discount department store in Lansing. According to Hulleberger, one of the reasons that Egbert had gone missing for a month was because two of his associates were responsible for the murder of Lori Murningham, and Egbert may have found out about it. She stated, quote, "Dallas is from a different generation, so he's not involved. But the people he is involved with, I have been told, also know about it. There are too many unanswered questions about this case than just a missing 16-year-old who went off to cool his head and find some inner peace," end quote. Even though Christine Gallagher had personally witnessed Lori get abducted by only one individual, Hulleberger alleged that there were two people involved in Lori's murder, and that she was killed because she knew them and could identify them. Well, investigators did look into Hulleberger's story, but ultimately determined that these two cases were not connected at all, and that Hulleberger may have fabricated the story in hopes of claiming a $5,000 reward which had been offered for Egbert's safe recovery. So yes, considering that Dungeons & Dragons was not even invented until years after Lori's murder, I think we can rule out any link. Lori's case would pretty much fade from the spotlight for the next 2 decades, and tragically, her mother Patty passed away in 1997, with her father Max following suit 3 years later. However, in August of 2001, Lori's body was exhumed with hopes of performing forensic testing which was not available at the time of her death. Given that she had been found in a swampy pond, hopes were not high that much forensic evidence would be available, but the exhumation uncovered 2 strands of pubic hair on Lori's body, and DNA testing would show that the hairs did not belong to her. It was then announced that an attempt would be made to test the hairs against the same man who had been identified by Christine Gallagher 3 decades earlier. By this point, the suspect was 54 years old and currently serving time in jail on misdemeanor charges, so a search warrant was used to obtain one of his pubic hairs for comparison to the hairs found on Lori's body. The hairs were sent to the FBI crime lab in Quantico, Virginia for DNA analysis, but they soon wound up facing a huge backlog when the terrorist attacks from September the 11th took place, as the lab found themselves having to test thousands of DNA samples in order to help identify remains which were found in the rubble from the collapse of the World Trade Center. As a result, the evidence was eventually turned over to the Department of Defense, who did not perform the DNA testing until 2002. In the end, the results were inconclusive, and since the DNA on the two hairs from Lori's body was so old and degraded, the genetic material was completely used up by the testing, so no further DNA analysis could be performed. There would be another shocking revelation in the September the 11th, 2001 edition of the Lansing State Journal, when they reported that a short time after Lori was killed, the same suspect was arrested and incarcerated in the Ingham County Jail on unrelated charges. While there, he supposedly told a fellow inmate that he was responsible for Lori's abduction and murder, and the inmate soon provided a statement about this to the police. But for some reason, nothing was done with this information. This 2001 article featured quotes from Raymond Scadeller, who had been Ingham County prosecutor at the time Lori was killed, and claimed this was the first time he had ever heard about this alleged jailhouse confession. Since the inmate who overheard the confession was no longer alive by this point, his statement could not be used as evidence. No charges were ever filed against the implicated suspect, and he died in San Diego, California in January of 2007. So after more than 50 years, the murder of Lori Murninghan still officially remains unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So this is a very frustrating case in which we pretty much know exactly what happened to the victim, since there was an eyewitness to her abduction, but the only thing we don't know is the identity of the perpetrator. Or rather, we have a pretty good idea of the killer's identity, but the authorities just never felt they had strong enough evidence to charge him. If you go through the newspaper archives from July of 1970, you'll find a ton of articles about Lori Murninghan's abduction, as it was not only featured in the Lansing State Journal, but it got nationwide coverage all over the United States. I'm sure this was largely due to the fact that Lori's father was the former mayor of Lansing and had only been out of office for a year at this point, but the ironic thing is that the perpetrator likely had no idea who Lori or her family was. She was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, and I'm sure the abductor was taken by complete surprise once they learned how much attention this crime received and saw their composite sketch being circulated everywhere. In the 11 days between Lori's abduction and the discovery of her body, the case pretty much got non-stop exposure, as there was hope that the perpetrator had just taken her in a moment of panic and would eventually decide to do the right thing and return her unharmed. It was theorized that he might have mistakenly believed that he killed Christine Gallagher when the gun discharged and took Lori with her because she was a witness, though it actually turned out that Lori was nearsighted and her glasses were inside her purse when this took place, so she may not have been able to make a positive identification, no matter what. But sadly, I think all these public pleas for the perpetrator to do the right thing and turn himself in wouldn't have made one iota of difference, because when Lori's body was found, her exact cause of death was manual strangulation. If the killer was panicky and felt he needed to eliminate Lori because she was an eyewitness, he could have ended it quickly by shooting her, but the fact that he went to the trouble of strangling her to death indicates a lot of rage and possibly a prior history of violence. He may have only entered the shop with the intention of committing robbery, but once he found out that a teenage girl was working there, he may have decided that he wanted to abduct her, though the level of decomposition made it impossible to determine if Lori was sexually assaulted. And as we're going to discuss momentarily, the person who is believed to be responsible for this crime is alleged to have preyed on other teenage girls. So if you look at the earliest media coverage of this case, there's very little indication that investigators had any promising suspects on the radar, and as far as I can tell, all the information about Christine Gallagher identifying him in a photo lineup was not made public until Lori's body was exhumed for DNA testing 3 decades later. While the Web Sleuth Forum has a thread about this case, and dating back to 2006, a number of posts have been made there by Lori's younger brother, Patrick, who was only 14 years old at the time of her murder, and offers his own insight into why this suspect was never charged with the crime. According to Patrick, the identity of Lori's abductor was known to police within the first 24 hours, but they may have had their own ulterior motives for not bringing him to justice, and the authorities never even told him about this guy until 1990, even though he had previously been investigated. I mentioned earlier that the suspect had an extensive criminal history, not only in Michigan, but in his hometown of Toledo, Ohio. But even though he was arrested several times on a number of different charges, it seemed like more often than not, he only received a suspended sentence and avoided jail time. Well, the story goes that in January of 1970, while he was serving a sentence for armed robbery, the authorities had him released from prison early so that he could function as a drug informant. But only 1 month later, he picked up two 14-year-old girls in Lansing and took them to a motel in Flint, where they were both raped by the suspect and one of his friends. The father of one of these girls subsequently filed a complaint with the Lansing Police Department, but even though the suspect was briefly detained, nothing ever came of this, and he did not even get sent back to prison on a parole violation. It was only after Lori's abduction took place, when this man was arrested again and held in the Ingham County Jail to deal with the situation involving the rape charges, and that's when he supposedly made a confession to another inmate that he was responsible for killing Lori. Patrick claims that his family never learned about this confession until after Lori's body was exhumed 31 years later, and I mentioned earlier that Raymond Scodeller, who was Ingham County prosecutor back in 1970, has also said that he was not told about this, even though it could have been used as evidence to bring charges against the suspect. In addition, Patrick has stated that there were at least four other witnesses who reported seeing this man abduct Lori from her workplace and take her to his car, which was parked up the block in a neighboring business lot. Yet if you look at the media coverage of this case, the impression you get is that Christine Gallagher was the only eyewitness, and I don't believe these other four people were ever asked to make an identification. Patrick also provided the name of the alleged perpetrator in that web sleuth thread, and even though this man has since passed away, I will still hold back on sharing his identity, since he's never been publicly named as a suspect or person of interest from law enforcement. But I did perform a search of his name at newspapers.com, and yes, a few articles came up which mentioned him getting arrested for various crimes unrelated to this case, so he definitely had a history of trouble with the law. Now, I've seen a number of cases, some of which have been featured on this podcast, where a missing or murdered victim's family is jerked around by law enforcement, who sometimes give off the impression that they don't actually want their loved one's case to be solved. I know it's not uncommon for law enforcement to sometimes protect their informants to allow them to avoid prison time for certain crimes if they consider them to be a valuable enough asset for providing information. However, would they really go so far as to protect someone who is responsible for abducting and murdering the teenage daughter of the former mayor? Well, I'm not sure this would be a case of wanting to protect the perpetrator, but rather the mistakes that put him in the position to commit this crime to begin with. In one of Patrick's web sleuth posts, he wrote, quote, "It's not so much belief that the local police bungled the investigation. However, I firmly believe that they have since, through orders from above, actively participated in obstructing justice so the terrible decisions made in the past do not come to light." End quote. Well, let's look at the timeline here. In January of 1970, 6 months before Lori's murder, the suspect was granted an early release from prison to function as a drug informant for the police. But even though he was accused of raping two teenage girls a short time later, the incident seems to have pretty much been swept under the rug. If proper procedure had been followed, this guy could have been sent back to prison on a parole violation, or at least held in jail to face the rape charges, and he still would have been behind bars on July the 9th instead of abducting and murdering Lori. Given what a prominent family the Murninghams were, if it came out that this tragedy could have been prevented by keeping this guy off the streets, then I imagine there would have been hell to pay. So I would not be surprised if there was a vested interest in ensuring that he never got charged with Lori's murder. Of course, the complication is that this case had a living witness, Christine Gallagher, who got a direct look at the perpetrator and identified him in a photo lineup, and it's not so easy to just sweep that under the rug. And to be fair, eyewitnesses are mistaken in criminal cases all the time, and Gallagher was unable to identify the suspect in a police lineup. But let's not forget that she described the man as having a goatee, which he had in his older mugshots, yet he was clean-shaven by the time the lineup took place. Given that the perpetrator's composite sketch was heavily circulated throughout the media during this time period, it would not surprise me at all if he decided to shave off his goatee in order to avoid the attention this crime was receiving. Yet some eyewitnesses would probably see through this and still be able to identify him without the goatee, but Gallagher wore thick glasses and did not have great eyesight, so seeing a clean-shaven individual in the police lineup might have completely thrown her off. Even so, it still might have been possible to build a case against this guy after the inmate came forward with this story about the alleged jailhouse confession, or if the other eyewitnesses who supposedly saw him fleeing the shop with Lori were asked to make an identification. But if someone in power really did not want this case to be solved, then the lack of identification from Gallagher, as well as the alibi he supposedly had on the afternoon of the crime, would have made for a convenient excuse not to charge him. I don't have too many specific details about this so-called alibi, but since it was provided by the suspect's mother, it's easy to be skeptical of it, unless there was other corroborating evidence placing this man at another location when Lori's abduction took place. Anyway, since the person who was believed to be the responsible party died 15 years ago, he will obviously never face justice for this crime. So is there a way to conclusively prove that he was the perpetrator after all this time? Well, in the past few years, forensic genealogy has made this a possibility, as we've seen a number of cases get solved because DNA testing was able to link evidence from the crime to a perpetrator who was already dead. We know that DNA from the prime suspect in this case is on file, but is there any surviving DNA evidence he can be linked to? The big obstacle was that Lori's body was in a swampy pond for about a week and a half before he was found, which destroyed most of the forensic evidence. And while an exhumation uncovered pubic hairs that likely belonged to the killer, the results were inconclusive, and the testing used up all the available genetic material. I know that DNA analysis has advanced so much these past two decades, and that if the testing had taken place today, maybe we could have gotten some more conclusive results, but unfortunately, it was not to be. So in the end, this case is pretty much an exercise in frustration, where everyone seems pretty certain who the responsible party was, but there just isn't the evidence to conclusively prove it. But even if Lori does not receive justice for what happened to her, the least this podcast can do is help keep her memory alive and ensure she is never forgotten. So before we bring this episode to a close, I want to take a few moments to discuss another cold case from Lansing, Michigan, and that's the unsolved murder of Karen Oatley. At the time she was killed, Karen Oatley was only 14 years old, and the crime was actually the first murder of a teenager to take place in Lansing since Lori Murnaghan. Karen lived with her parents, Theron Lee and Sandra Oatley, as well as her two brothers, but suffered from a hearing impairment, as she had been born nearly deaf and relied on the usage of a hearing aid. As a result, Karen sometimes had difficulties with speech as she grew up, but by the time she reached adolescence, Karen had blossomed into a very outgoing girl who was heavily involved with school and church activities. She helped manage the boys' track team at Gardner Junior High School, which involved carrying their equipment and charting the runners' times, and she was planning to sign up to be the coach's teacher's aide in the fall. Karen also played on the girls' volleyball team at St. Casimir's Catholic Church, and was essentially considered to be the leader on the team, as she removed her hearing aid whenever she played, and would rely on hand signals and lip reading to communicate. In 1979, Karen completed her last day of summer school on Friday, August the 3rd, and was set to start her freshman year as a 9th grade student at Gardner Junior High in the fall. At around 6 p.m. on the evening of Sunday, August the 5th, Karen left her home on her 10-speed bicycle in order to go for a ride. She was planning to leave on a trip to visit her grandparents the following day, but she never returned home, and after her father canvassed the neighborhood and failed to find her, he contacted the police to report Karen missing at 10 o'clock. Even though Karen had no prior history of taking off, the police initially treated her disappearance as a runaway, but it wasn't long before it became a homicide investigation. A search effort took place the following day, and at 1:20 p.m., Karen's grandfather discovered her abandoned bicycle in some dense underbrush located behind Gardner Junior High. The spot was only 5 blocks from the Oatley residence, and there was still no sign of Karen, so a police tracking dog was brought in to search for her. Well, less than 1 hour later, the dog found Karen's body along a fence line in a wooded area, only about 50 yards from where her bicycle was found. An autopsy would reveal that her exact cause of death was asphyxiation, as she was strangled and had her throat slashed with a sharp instrument after she was already dead. Since Karen was fully clothed when she was found, and there was no evidence that she had been sexually molested, no one could figure out the motive for her murder. A special phone line was set up in order for people to send in tips about the crime, but there were no witnesses who reported seeing or hearing anything unusual on the night Karen was killed. The Lansing Police Department also implemented a secret witness program where people could call a phone number or write to a certain post office box if they wanted to anonymously share tips. This information would then be given to the police, and anyone who called or wrote in would only be identified with a 6-digit code number. If any of their information led to a case being solved, the tipsters could use their code number to claim any rewards which were being offered. This secret witness program would remain in effect in Lansing for the next several years, not just for Karen's case, but for a number of other unsolved crimes from the city. In the weeks following Karen's murder, a couple of potential suspects were questioned, none of whom have ever had their names revealed publicly. The person who seemed to get the most attention was an individual known only as Hair Man, because he was known for having a strong fetish for hair and would pursue teenage girls who had long hair, which Karen did. After the police received a tip that two eyewitnesses had seen Hair Man with Karen on the day she disappeared, they decided to bring him in for questioning. They found a yellow plastic garbage bag in Hair Man's possession, containing about 250 to 300 photos of himself with young girls and boys, and it also contained a copy of the Lansing State Journal, which had a front-page story about Karen's death. Oddly, a school photo of a long-haired young girl resembling Karen was stapled to the newspaper's front page, but it turned out to be a photo of someone else. Investigators eventually tracked down and spoke to the two witnesses who had supposedly seen Hair Man with Karen, but they both denied ever having seen them together. In the end, it turned out that Hair Man had an ironclad alibi that day, so he was ruled out as a suspect. The investigation would eventually hit a brick wall and fade from the spotlight. Karen's family left Lansing during the early 1980s, and when the Lansing State Journal published a new article about Karen's murder in June of 2014, her parents were living in Fort Myers, Florida. When interviewed, Theron Lee Oatley said that he hadn't spoke to anyone in law enforcement about the case for several years, and described the pain of not knowing what happened as, quote-unquote, like having a bamboo shoot under your fingernails. So unfortunately, there isn't really all that much which can be said to analyze this case. This isn't like the murder of Lori Murnaghan, where everyone believes they know who the perpetrator was but lack the evidence to make an arrest. Here, it sounds like no one has ever had the faintest idea about who the killer might be. During the early stages of the investigation, the police interviewed a couple of potential suspects, such as the aforementioned Hair Man, but there was never anything to link these individuals to the crime, and the leads went nowhere. In August of 1982, the Lansing State Journal published an article which stated that notorious serial killer Coral Eugene Watts, nicknamed the Sunday Morning Slasher, was being investigated for potential links to Karen's murder and a number of unsolved cold cases from Michigan. Even though Watts was apprehended in Texas, he spent most of his life living in Michigan and is believed to be responsible for the murders of anywhere from 14 to over 100 victims. Watts has since passed away, and the methods he used for his crimes included strangulation and slashing his victims' throats, which is exactly what happened to Karen. It seems like the investigation into Watts never led anywhere, as the Lansing PD simply said that they did not think Watts was responsible for any of the unsolved murders from the area during that time period, though they couldn't completely rule out the possibility either. But the issue with Karen Oatley's murder is that there was virtually no evidence to work with, so theoretically, anyone could have been responsible. I mean, because there was so little to go on, the original investigators acknowledged that they couldn't even state with any certainty if the killer was male or female. Since her bicycle was found 50 yards from her body, someone probably attacked Karen and dragged her body into the woods, and due to her hearing impairment, they could have sneaked up on her from behind, and she never saw it coming. But since the perpetrator did not sexually assault Karen or even remove her clothing, what could their motive have been? Why did they decide to asphyxiate a 14-year-old girl before slashing her throat? Was Karen specifically targeted, or was she just selected at random by someone who wanted to commit murder? Of course, no one was thinking about DNA back in 1979, but I'm not sure if investigators had much in the way of physical evidence at all. The Lansing State Journal still makes mention of Karen's murder every few years whenever they publish articles about unsolved cold cases from the area, so the crime has not been completely forgotten. But I just don't get the impression that there have been any solid leads at all these past 40 years. Without any eyewitnesses or physical evidence, it's possible that the only way this case might ever be solved is if someone decides to brag about it or make a confession, but the whole crime is just a major head-scratcher. But it's also a major tragedy, because even though she was born with a handicap, it sounds like Karen had done everything in her power to overcome it and live life to the fullest, until someone decided to take it away from her. It would be nice if after all these years, they could find conclusive answers for the families of Lori Murnihan and Karen Oatley. So if you happen to have any information about either of these cases, please contact the Lansing Police Department at 517-483-4600. That's 517-483-4600. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Michelle Bolesky for narrating the opening of this week's episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you'd most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a special bonus episode about the unsolved disappearance of Mel Wiley, a police chief who vanished from Hinckley Township, Ohio in 1985. In addition, we've dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself, Jules, and our other co-host Ashley discuss the unsolved 2004 murder of Sarah Fox. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listener who has signed up with us on Patreon this week, and that's Lisa M. Thank you so much for your support. Another reminder that, provided that it is safe enough to travel there, I'm hoping to appear at CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on June the 11th and 12th. If you would like to get a 10% discount on tickets to this event, please visit crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COL22. Once again, that's crimecon.co.uk and the promo code is COL22. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show of each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, in a matter of days, I'm going to be traveling to Las Vegas to appear on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, and to commemorate the occasion, next week's episode is going to feature an unsolved cold case from that city. So until then, have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶